Hello, this is Caleb Keith, the director of the 1517 Podcast Network, with an important announcement from the network to you. During the month of June, your favorite podcasts from 1517 are going to be participating in a podcast fundraiser. During this time, we are seeking to raise $50,000 for the 1517 podcasts. The 1517 Podcast Network has created free gospel-centered content for over 5 years. We have new episodes of our 19 podcasts coming out every day of the week, and we never fill them with ads or place them behind a paywall. That's why this June, we're asking listeners across our shows to support 1517 and the teachers and creators behind your favorite theological resources. Your support directly impacts our ability to build and maintain podcast content that was listened to over 6 million times last year alone. Thank you to the listeners who enjoy and share our podcasts. A special thanks to those who financially support our shows. We hope that you consider supporting this podcast and the rest of the network during our June fundraiser. And again, that goal is $50,000. One of the easiest ways you can help is by signing up for a monthly recurring donation. All you have to do is follow the Support This Show link at the top of the show notes or go to 1517.org/donate-podcasts to support your favorite shows. Again, we appreciate your support. Enjoy this episode of your favorite 1517 podcast.
Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other things that are going on over there. One of the things that's going on, we're wrapping it up. In the month of June, we're doing the Podcast Network fundraiser. If you've not jumped on board with that, we would appreciate if you would. There is a link in the show notes that says support this show. It's how we're able to do this stuff. That way we don't have to have ads on the shows and we don't have to have a paywall. You know, a lot of podcasts that have a backlog the way that we do, you know. Chad and I both are big hardcore history fans. We like that Dan Carlin hardcore history. But, you know, if I'm going on a road trip, which I will be next week going on vacation, and I'm going to have to go, and if I want anything released, you know, a couple episodes back, which is what I want, I'm going to have to go and I have to buy those episodes, you know, because they're behind the paywall. I've got to pay for them individually, which, you know, I'm happy to do because you got to support the podcasters you like. But we don't do it that way. We just have donors. And so if you want to help us continue to do what we do, and not just us, but everything that 1517 does, all the podcasts, I mean, there's 20 shows, you can become a supporter. And so you can follow that link or you can go over to 1517.org/donate-podcasts, and you can make a contribution there. We appreciate all those who have done that. Chad, we are in Nehemiah chapter 6. Nehemiah had to do a little house cleaning. He had to take care of some internal stuff. There was some lending and some interest going on. There's some oppression of the poor. We got to talk about how, you know, Jesus has this thing going on. And by Jesus, of course, I just mean God, but Jesus is the one that said this. That, hey, the poor you will always have with you, but also make sure you treat the poor well. Both of these things are true. So he doesn't think that you can solve every economic problem, but he does not think that the fact that there will be poor people means that you just get to treat them any way you want, that you should always treat the poor with compassion. And that was not going on. And so Nehemiah had to fix some of that. You know, he had to bring some priests in to witness some vows and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, he got to become governor. And he governed in a very generous way. He governed in a way that where he did not avail himself of the allowances that the governor would get. So, like, there are certain things that a governor was allowed to do that are financially beneficial, things that would make his life easier. And he didn't do those things. Now, this is probably because he had means, but hey, it's because someone has means, it's never stopped someone from trying to get more means. But Nehemiah didn't go that route, and that sort of made things easier for the people. He didn't want to take anything from them, and so he governed in a very generous way. And that's kind of where we ended. And you know, you got to know how the Old Testament works. When everything seems like it's going good, when all the problems seem to be solved, you know, like we had We had some hindrances to the building, and then Nehemiah solved those, and then it felt like everyone was ready to work, and they got some stuff built. That was nice. Then you had this internal oppression of the poor, and Nehemiah fixed that. All right, fine. All right, good. Finally, the wall's built. You know, the poor are being taken care of. We're good to go. Everything's great. And so you know the very next chapter something is going to happen, because that's just not how the Bible works, because that's not how life works.
Yeah, you got to get to the very end of the Bible before you have a they lived happily ever after.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got not until the end do you get that point. It's pretty much just as you described it. So we're going to shift this time. So last chapter was about internal problems amongst people, you know, rich, poor, all that kind of stuff. And now we're going to shift back to these guys we've heard about before, the external issues. These people who in various sorts of ways have been trying to mock, taunt, suppress, threaten the builders to make sure this does not happen. Guys like Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arab and all the rest of these guys. So that's how chapter 6 starts out. These fellows, they heard, and the rest of the enemies too. It's not like this was the extent of those who were opposed to Nehemiah. A whole bunch of folks heard that I had built the wall. So this is Nehemiah, first person. This is part of his memoir. So heard that I'd built the wall and that there was no breach left in it. It wasn't like he was completely done, though, because in parentheses we said, we have, although up to that time I had not set up the doors and the gate. So he's, all right, he's basically through. You know, everything's pretty much in place, but not totally. So when they're almost done, Sanballat and Geshem send this message to Nehemiah. And I don't know why they thought this was going to work. I mean, it seems a bit naive, given all the bad blood that exists between them, given all the threats, the taunts, the suppression, everything else they've tried. Now they think that this is going to work. They say to Nehemiah, hey, why don't you meet us in this place called HaKephirim in the plain of Ono? Now that's a common, you can read the commentaries. There's all sorts of speculation about exactly where this is, but I'd say the majority agree that even though we don't know where HaKephirim is, it's probably a village that's in the plain of Ono. And Ono, O-N-O, is kind of northwest of Jerusalem. Probably kind of a in-between spot between Samaria and Judea. But anyway, they want Nehemiah to leave Jerusalem and to meet them at this HaKephirim place in the plain of Ono.
Now, Chad, this is like if somebody says, why don't you meet me at the OK Corral at high noon?
We're gonna have a beer together.
We're just gonna hang out.
We're just gonna talk. That's all.
You, yeah, me, yeah. Okay, Corral, high noon. It's gonna be great.
Yeah. So unnecessarily, Nehemiah adds this, but they intended to do me harm.
Yeah.
There are times in the Bible states the very obvious, and this is one of those cases. They intended to do me harm. Yeah, I based upon the past, I would say that is a fair judgment to make, given the fact that they've tried to do everything to stop the work and it has been unsuccessful. I mean, what they wanted to do has been unsuccessful, whereas Nehemiah and his workers have been successful. Now, you got to admire, I mean, Nehemiah's a little bit coy here because he doesn't come right out and say, no, do you think I'm an idiot? You're trying to kill me. He responds, he sends messengers to them. This is kind of a back and forth. Sends messengers to them saying, I'm busy, basically. I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down now. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? That's a pretty good response.
I like it because he's like, oh, dude, I don't know if you heard, but doing some really good work over here. Doing some awesome work. This is I got some great work
this
going
wall.
On. Yeah, yeah, it's great. It's really, it's going
big
great.
Wall. Yeah. Yeah, it is really, it's almost a smart aleck kind of comment coming from Nehemiah. This is Nehemiah saying, I'm not stupid. I know exactly what you guys are doing, but I'm not going to tell you that outright. I'm just going to let you know that the work you're trying to stop, oh, it's going great.
It's awesome. Yeah,
here. Yeah, so awesome wall we're building here. And so, I mean, I'm on a roll here. Why would I stop and come down to visit with you guys? I mean, I'd really like to visit the OK Corral and everything. I've heard it's great. but I'm kind of busy right
now. Yeah, maybe if you want to talk to me, you should come up here by this awesome wall and talk to me.
Yeah. I'm on this wall. It's really tall, wide, big. You should, yeah. Let's have a little get together here.
You come shout up at me. It'd be great.
Yeah. Well, these guys, I mean, they try this and then they try it again. They try it again. Four times they try this. Verse 4 says, they sent to me four times in this way. You know, maybe they word it a little bit differently every time. Who knows? But either way, they're going to give this a shot. I mean, over and over. And every time Nehemiah, I guess, sends back a similar response, I answer them in the same manner. I don't know why. I mean, okay, twice, but four times?
Yeah.
These guys are desperate.
Yeah.
These guys are desperate. So
points for tenacity.
Yes, there you go. Points for tenacity. So after the fourth failure, verse 5, I guess they're going to try a little bit different tact this time. We're going to try a little blackmail by false accusation, I suppose we could call this. So verse 5 says, in the same way, Sanballat, for the fifth time, sent his servant to me with an open letter in his hand. I suppose these other ones were just, word of mouth. Messenger shows up, says, hey, I got a message from Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem, and they say blah, blah, blah. So they're going to write it down this way. Maybe it's supposed to pack some extra weight, you know, be a little bit more convincing. But either way, get this open letter. Who knows what it was written on? I mean, a lot of times they wrote letters on potsherds, just, you know, little scraps of pottery that are broken apart. Archaeologists found tons of those. But anyway, whatever it's written on, here's what it says. Verse 6. It is reported among the nations. And this is the equivalent of they're saying. Yeah. You know what? I've heard they're saying. So it's reported among the nations. And Geshem also says it. I guess that's supposed to carry some weight. Geshem the Arab. He also says this. That you, Nehemiah, that you and the Jews intend to rebel. And that's why you're building the wall. And as if that's not enough. According to these reports, you wish to become their king. And it goes on, verse 7. And you've also set up prophets to proclaim concerning you in Jerusalem, there is a king in Judah. So this is the accusation. Then they go on. And now the king, talking here about the Persian king, the overlord of this entire empire. And now the king will hear of these reports. In other words, we're going to let him know. So now come and let us take counsel together. I don't know. It doesn't seem very convincing to me.
Yeah. I mean, they're trying to be like, okay, listen, man, there's some stuff going around and we'd love to, you know, hear you say, you know, to our face that this is not the case. I mean, you know, maybe we can get out in front of these rumors. I don't know how much time we got before they reach the king, and you know that's not gonna go well. So maybe we can help you out here, but I'm gonna need to see you for sure. Like, you can't just send me a message. I'm gonna need to, you know, see, look into your eyes as these words come out of your mouth. This is a pretty desperate attempt to get him down there in person, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, of course, this is all written from Nehemiah's perspective, but. You know, the way he reports things, these guys don't come across as the sharpest tools in the tool shed. I mean, I don't know why they thought this would work. When someone has been against you time and time and time again, and then they come up with something like this. I mean, I suppose a fear tactic sometimes works. You know, of course, there's been plenty of prophets in the past who were behind the king. So maybe they think, this is going to at least spark a little bit of fear in the heart of Nehemiah.
Well, and also, I mean, this is one of those things like people are saying, and you're like, by people, do you mean you? This is like when unknown, like someone who just like loves to gossip and then comes to you and said like, oh, you know what I heard people are saying about you? And I'm like, by people, do you mean things that you were saying about me? that you were like getting other people to say about me? Is that what you mean? Because that's what I feel like you mean.
Yeah, and by people, you mean only you and whoever else you've been telling this to. Yes.
Yeah.
Wait, that's the way human nature works.
Like, where this? I wonder where this rumor got started. I really wonder.
Yeah, I wonder what the source of this might be. I wonder what, maybe we can trace it back to the first person who said this. Well, Nehemiah, undeterred, I love his response. I mean, it's short, it's blunt, it's to the point. And it's one of these cases, I think, where who are the truly courageous? Those who know they stand on the truth.
Right.
Right. I mean, there's nothing that will give you courage to stand up and remain here. We still stand. Besides the truth. I mean, if you know what you're holding to is true, then man, talk about being filled with courage to stand up for what's right. So Nehemiah says, he sends a letter saying, "No such things as you say have been done. Why? For you are inventing them out of your own mind." End. You're just making stuff up. Nobody's saying this. None of this is happening. You're just coming up with these, you're just pulling these lies out of your own head. None of them are true. And then verse 9 gives us Nehemiah's his understanding of what really their motivation is. So this is description of why they're doing what they're doing. "For they all wanted to frighten us, thinking their hands will drop from the work and it will not be done." Of course, I mean, that's the whole reason they're wanting to pull this off is to get them to stop building the walls. Because if the walls built, to reiterate what we've said many other times, if the walls are rebuilt, then these guys no longer have control over Jerusalem, which they probably did before Nehemiah came along and started this kind of work. So you want to, you know, the person you want to control, well, you control them by keeping them weak. So that's what they wanted to do. They want to keep Jerusalem weak so they have control over it. Nehemiah comes along and he's destroying all of their plans. And so they're opposed to him for this reason. Now, the end of this is couched in the form of a prayer. So after he says they all wanted to frighten us, thinking their hands will drop from the work and it will not be done, a lot of English translations, including the ESV, say, "But now, O God, strengthen my hands." The problem with that is that there is no "O God" in the Hebrew text. It just says, "And now strengthen my hand." So it's can be translated as something like, "But now I strengthen my own hands." In other words, I can continue the work. So maybe it's a prayer. If it is, there's really nothing in the Hebrew that would suggest that it actually is. So anyway, it's either Nehemiah saying, "I continued undeterred, I strengthened my hands to continue with the work," or perhaps it is it's a prayer that he utters. Either way, he's not going to be deterred by the people who were opposing him.
Yeah, it's kind of weird that they stick the "ill God" in there. I don't exactly know why they do that. I don't know, because to me, sometimes people, translators, as they're translating, forget the sort of human elements to certain things. Now imagine, like, Nehemiah is writing this down and he's saying, like, all right, so they're coming to me like five times, then they said, "Oh, people are saying," I know that they're not saying that, "the people that are saying that are the people that are sending me these letters, so I know what's going on here. What they really wanted me to do, they wanted my hands to drop from this work, but all that happened with all these letters is I just strengthened my hands." Like, this is like some hold my beer talk. I don't read this as, it doesn't need to be a prayer. He's just saying, like, I'm really sick of reading these letters. Let me tell you the actual result of all these letters, and you're like trying to make this happen. You thought I was building fast before, dude? Like, you never seen wall building like you're about to see.
Yeah, that's very true to human nature. Yeah. We've all been in that situation too. Yeah, somebody opposes us, we'd be like, "Oh, I'm going to double down.
Yeah. Oh, this.
I'm going to triple down.
Oh, this wall building was bothering you? Oh, well, you've watched this."
Yeah. You thought you saw wall building before. Now you're really gonna see it. So that didn't work. Obviously, the four messages, "Hey, meet us at the OK Corral," that was rebuffed. He's too busy. And then the whole, rumors are going around. Well, he says, "That's not true. You're just making this stuff up." So they come up with a different tactic. "We're not done yet." You know, if they have anything, they have persistence. So now, this is a little bit sneakier than the other ones. The other ones, I mean, you can see through those. Well, it turns out that one of these guys, Tobiah, he's got some connections. He's got some pretty remarkable and deep connections to people in Jerusalem. In fact, as we'll discover more and more as we read through Nehemiah, he and his son are married in such a way that they have connections with the people in Jerusalem. We're gonna, in a few more chapters, we'll find out that for a while, Tobiah was actually living in Jerusalem before Nehemiah showed up, and had a room close to the temple. So what's going to happen here is that they're going to have a hired prophetic, prophetic in quotes here, hired prophetic gun that's going to try and get Nehemiah to mess up in a big public way. So here's the way it works. Verse 10. Now I went into the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was confined to his home. Now, we don't know why he was confined to his home. Speculations abound. Some people say it was because of a ritual defilement. Some people say it was because of a vow. Some people say it was unknown reason. Whatever it was, we're really not told, and you can't really tell from the Hebrew either. But he was at his home. So presumably, he either sends a messenger or he sends a letter to Nehemiah saying, "Hey, I got a message for you. I've got a message from God for you." So Nehemiah shows up at his house. And here's what he says. "Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple." And when he says within the temple, he's not talking about the four courts. He's not talking about the courts. He's talking about like the house itself, like the holy place. So let us meet together in the house of God within the temple. And let's close the doors of the temple because they're coming to kill you. They is not specified, but presumably Nehemiah understood who this was going to be. Of course, you know, all these guys who have been threatening him. They are coming to kill you. In fact, they're coming to kill you by night. Now, you can't see this in some English translations. In the Hebrew, this is set in the form of a typical prophetic oracle. So like when, you know, when you read prophetic books, it's arranged differently on the page in poetry form. So it's presented as kind of a prophetic oracle. So even the way he says this, it's like this is a true oracle from God. And he's basically saying, "Hey, we need to go hide you. So the best place for us to hide is in the temple, in the very house of God itself, because tonight there's going to be some people coming in to assassinate you." So verse 11, Nehemiah responds to him and says, "Should such a man as I run away? And what man such as I could go into the temple and live? I will not go in."
I think this response is awesome because he gets to like do two things at the same time. One, "Should such a man as I run away?" Okay, so like, This is the way of saying, like, dude, I'm not the kind of guy that runs away. What kind of man do you think I am? Like, I'm not that kind of guy. I'm not a runner. That's not what I do. And men like me, maybe men like you, run away, but men like me, they don't run away. So like, there's this confidence. There's some cockiness there, right? But that is good. It's like
to continue our Wild West analogy. This is Wyatt Earp.
Yeah, he's like, I don't run.
You think I'm gonna get my horse and run the other direction?
Yeah, it's not what I do.
Think I am?
Yeah. But then says, so he's not that kind of man. But then says, "And what man such as I could go into the temple and live?" So he's like, I'm not the kind of man that runs away. I'm not that kind of man. I'm not a coward. But I'm not a holy man.
I'm also not a priest.
Yeah, so like this is great. So he's doing both things at the same time, where he gets to have this bravado of like, I'm no coward, but he's also like, dude, I'm not worthy to go into the temple either. Like, don't get. Mm-hmm. I know what kind of man I am. Yeah. So this is not going to work with me. Like, I'm not. You took me for someone who was scared enough to believe that I would go do something that I know I shouldn't do, but I'm not scared. And I'm well aware that I have no business in the temple. It's great.
These guys have not figured out that Nehemiah, I mean, every man has his weaknesses, right? We all know that we have chinks in our armor. Well, Nehemiah's chink is not fear. So they keep trying the fear tactics and it's not working, but you know, they keep trying the same kinds of approaches and all of them keep backfiring.
Yeah.
not a coward. And also, I'm not a priest.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to run away, but I'm also not going to run into the temple because, you know, I know what happens to people who aren't supposed to be in the temple, who go into the temple. We have like documented evidence of that. We have a king who ended up with leprosy when he attempted this. So ain't going to happen. I will not go in. And verse 12 says, I understood and saw that God had not sent him, but he pronounced a prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. I also love this because this is a great case where how do you test prophecy in the Old Testament? Well, you know, a pretty easy way to test prophecy is if a supposed prophet says something which directly contradicts the word of God, then he's a false prophet. So this is some pretty low hanging prophetic judgment kind of stuff going on. So if a prophet comes along and says, you should steal, that's a false prophet. Prophet comes along and says, hey, we should worship other gods, that's a false prophet. And likewise here, if a prophet comes along and says, you should go into the temple, well, there you go. Yeah. He's a false prophet. Hired prophet at that.
If a prophet comes up to you and says, hey, you should hide in the ark. did you know?
It's funny you said that. Last night, my daughter was over and we watched Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yes.
Yeah. 1981. Yeah. So we're recording this on the Monday after Father's Day. So it was a Father's Day movie for me. I love that movie. So we were, yeah. You know, I mean, you know from the Bible, you don't want to go inside the ark. You also know from the movie, you don't want to mess with
it. You know,
you don't want to mess with the ark.
I'm about to go way off track here, but I don't mean to ruin Raiders of the Lost Ark because I love it. But here is what's true about that movie. Indiana Jones doesn't matter to the outcome of that movie at all. If you remove Indiana Jones from the entire plot, the end of that movie is exactly the same.
It's true. Yeah.
I mean,
he is tied up during that whole thing. So, yeah.
Well, even just say that you just have this movie, but Indiana Jones doesn't exist. The end of the movie, what ends up happening in that movie is that they find the ark and open it and all die. This happens no matter what.
Right. It's always going to end poorly. It doesn't matter.
It's not as though he stops them. It's not as though he prevents them from finding it. He's just there.
Yeah, so don't hide in the ark. You know, if someone happens to find the Ark of the Covenant, just bury it again. Leave it where it is. So anyway, this guy was hired. He's a hired prophetic gun by Tobiah in Sanballat. So they, you know, every other effort had failed. They thought, well, you know what? We have some connections. We know people in the city. And so let's work our magic here and see if this is going to work. So verse 13 says, for this purpose he was hired, that I should be afraid and act in this way and sin. And so they could give me a bad name in order to taunt me. Oh, well, yeah, you know the way this would work. Yeah, word would get out. Even if Nehemiah wasn't struck down when he goes into the temple, word's going to get out. You know, oh, our governor, did you hear what a coward he is? He went and hid inside the temple. First of all, he's not supposed to be there. But I mean, what kind of leader does that? And so, yeah, this is all going to not be good for Nehemiah had he followed this. But of course, he sees right through it. And then verse 14 is a prayer where Nehemiah does this at least more than once in the book. He utters his prayer and says, oh my God, I want you to remember a couple folks here.
Yeah, calling on that God to remember. But this is, we talked about this a lot. When you're asking God to remember, you're asking him to do something. And in this particular time, I don't think he's asking God to remember his faithful, loving kindness and all his promises or anything like that.
No, this is a slightly different kind of remembering. This is not a God remembered Noah in the ark kind of remembering. So remember Tobiah and Sanballat, oh my God, according to these things that they did. And presumably he's also asking God to remember this Shemaiah dude. But that's not the name that he mentions. He says, also the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets who wanted to make me afraid. Now, that's not even right, because you can't just drop a name like that and not tell us anything. That's what Nehemiah does. It's like, you're like, it's a page turner. You're like, he never tells us anything.
Yeah.
We don't know who this woman is. We don't know what she did. We don't know what she said. So it's kind of a unfair teaser where he just kind of lobs that out there and gives us absolutely no more information about her.
You know what you find about God remembering? If the prayer is for God to remember who he is, great. This is a great thing. This is what you want. If the prayer is for God to remember who you are or someone else is, this is not good. When it comes to me, Chad, I don't know how you feel about this. When God is thinking about me, I want him to remember who he is. I definitely don't want him to like really think hard about who I am.
Yeah. I want remember Jesus, yes. Heavenly Father. That, right. I want God to forget a whole lot of things about me because, generally speaking, when I'm thinking about what I did in reference to God, it's not good.
Yeah, so, dude. If I'm standing before God, he's like, hey, aren't you Daniel? I'll be like, yeah. Hey, remember who you are, though. That's the important thing. I'm not the important one here. Just remember your nature. Just remember, you know.
Yeah. Hey, I'm not going to get up in front of God and list all of the reasons that he should remember me.
No.
Number one, the list is very short. There's like nothing on there. But I can list a whole lot of things that God has done for me and who he is. And and thankfully, that's what he remembers.
I mean, isn't it interesting that like a prayer of judgment can be reduced down to just, hey, make sure you remember these guys. Yeah. That's it. That's all you have to ask God to do. Hey, just remember these guys, okay? Like, ooh, all right.
Yeah, there's no, and drop some fire and brimstone on their heads, flatten their houses, give them leprosy, nothing.
Just remember who they really are.
Remember these names, Tobiah, Sanballat, and the prophetess Noadiah, and, you know, the rest of the prophets who tried to make me afraid. She's, by the way, not the only prophetess. We've encountered some of these before. Mm-hmm. There's, I don't know, half a dozen maybe that are mentioned by name in the rest of the scriptures. And I think with this one and then one exception, one other one, the other ones are positive. They're prophetesses through whom God spoke. But this prophetess was basically another hired gun in the service of the enemy. So anyway, that's kind of the end of that section. And now, you know, drum roll, we finally finished the wall. It really hadn't been that long. Verse 15 says it was finished. The wall was finished on the 25th day of the month Elul, which is like August, September. So 6 months in the Hebrew calendar. The wall was finished on the 25th day of Elul in 52 days.
Yeah, so all this happens in 52 days, huh?
So less than 2 months.
Yeah.
That's an awful lot to happen. I mean, the construction alone would have been impressive in 52 days. But when you add to that all the opposition, all the threats, all the setbacks, all the, you know, walking around with a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other, it's quite a bit to accomplish in 52 days.
So, yeah. No wonder these guys are getting nervous. They're like, these guys are building this wall. And man, I'll tell you what, like this wall is going up.
Yeah. I mean, we even kind of catch that in the next verse. When all our enemies heard of it, that is when they heard the wall was finished, all the nations around us were afraid and fell greatly in their own esteem because they perceived that this work had been accomplished with the help of God.
There you go.
Meaning that, they looked at it and, I mean, they were impressed just like we are, but they were even more impressed because they, you know, they saw the state of the wall. They realized how this would usually go down. So the fact that it was finished so soon, even they look at it and they're like, well, as much as we hate to admit it, this had to have been with God's involvement. There's no other way. So they fall in their own esteem and they realize that, you know, God must have had a hand in this. So verse 17 says, and this is kind of a further elaboration on what I was hinting at earlier. Moreover, in those days, the nobles of Judah sent many letters to Tobiah, and Tobiah's letters came to them. For many in Judah were bound by oath to him, to Tobiah. Why? Because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Arah, and his son, so and Tobiah's son, Jehohanan, had taken the daughter of Meshulam, the son of Berechiah, as his wife. Now, forget all the names. Basically, what we have going on here is that these guys, it's not like they were unknown in Jerusalem. It's not like they were unconnected to Jerusalem. There was at least a sizable group of people in Jerusalem under the authority of Nehemiah who were bound by oath and being informants against Nehemiah in order to try and undermine his authority and make sure this did not happen. So, I mean, it's bad enough to kind of have faced this external opposition. It was bad enough to have kind of the internal turmoil between the rich and the poor and the lending and the usury and all that stuff going on. But now we find out also that when all this mess was happening, he got these, you know, secret letters going back and forth between Tobiah and all these people he has on his side, on the inside, who are doing everything they can because they're bound by marriage, because they're bound by oath to make sure that Nehemiah's work does not come to its fulfillment. And says verse 10, they spoke of his good deeds in my presence. Imagine that. So you're in Nehemiah's presence. You're like, you know, I know you've had some issues with Tobiah, but he's actually, you know, let me tell you some, you know, once it was my kid's birthday and he gave him like a great present and you should have seen him, you know, what he did this one time. I know he kind of comes across as a little bit rough, but in his heart of hearts, he's really a good guy.
Yeah. it's pretty weird.
Doesn't work. Yeah, it's kind of a strange thing, but I mean, wouldn't you think if I'm Nehemiah and I have these my fellow Israelites coming up to me and bragging about how good this guy is who's trying to kill me, then don't you think I would kind of see through like, what connection do you have to Tobiah? Why would you be telling me this? But yeah, anyway, that's what happened.
Well, it seems
and
like
they
there's,
reported
there's,
my words to him.
Well, there's some sort of thing where it seems that Tobiah is like, hey, trying to get this guy, I'm trying to lure this guy out, trying to get him to meet me at these places. So they're having they're talking Tobiah up, trying to make this happen. This is concerning if you're Nehemiah because you feel like you have people close to you who are in debt or unhelpfully committed to this person that you feel has ill will towards you. I mean, and Nehemiah says it then, and Tobiah sent letters to make me afraid, which we already know. I mean, he's just reiterating that, like, hey, I had these people saying all this stuff, talking this guy up while he's doing this. So, I mean, if you're Nehemiah, you got to take a good hard look at the people around you and be like, okay, like, where are your allegiances at? Like, where are you? Mm. What are you actually trying to accomplish here?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You get to end this chapter, and it makes me really admire Nehemiah even more. I mean, this guy, he had an uphill battle.
Yeah.
I mean, he arrives, as far as we know, with no construction experience. It wasn't like he was a bricklayer in Babylon before. He was a cupbearer. The dude knew wine. And he shows up, takes over, and inspires the people, corrects problems, deals with... I mean, he's got stuff happening all around him. And still, he is able to pull it off, which is remarkable with regard to him, but even more remarkable when you consider that, God was working through all of this mess in order to bring this to its completion. So, anyway, that's the end of chapter 6. There's just like 4 verses at the beginning of chapter 7 that we'll kind of wrap up with here. Now, when the wall had been built, and I had set the doors, and the gatekeepers, and the singers, and the Levites had been appointed, I gave my brother, Hanani, and then another guy with almost the same name, Hananiah. So he gives his brother, Hanani, and this other guy, Hanani, the governor of the castle. He gives these two H guys, one's his brother, one's the governor of the castle. He gives them charge over Jerusalem. So he's appointing people that he trusts, he knows that he can rely on as those who are in charge of certain parts of Jerusalem. Because he says he was a more faithful and God-fearing man than many. I'm sure Nehemiah was very careful as to who he selected as leaders over Jerusalem, given everything we've been just discussing. You know,
yeah, so
he's only going to appoint people he could trust, he knows, like his brother.
Well, so he's got his brother and then this other guy, and like, who is this other guy? And you're like, well, all you need to know about him is you don't need to know, like, oh, he was this guy's son, and that guy, you know, and it was great because this guy had helped me out, so I appointed his son. No, the only thing you need to know about him is that... he was more faithful and God-fearing than most.
Yes.
That's why I appointed him.
That's what, and he had no connection to Tobiah, probably.
Probably not.
Yes. And I said to them, and this is a little bit confusing here. I said to them, this is the ESV, let not the gates of Jerusalem be open until the sun is hot. And while they're still standing guard, let them shut and bar the doors. That can be translated more than one way, which of course leads to scholars on Nehemiah and Hebrew scholars positing different kinds of translations here. Basically boils down to what I was able to see, basically two options. So one is, and this is what the ESV suggests. So don't open the gates right away. Just because the sun's beginning to come up doesn't mean you're supposed to unbar the gates and swing them wide open. Wait a while until it's fully light, until the sun is hot, and then you can open them. And then make sure that people are standing guard, and then later in the day you can bar the doors for the evening. That's one way to understand this. The other way is that you can translate this basically that when it gets hot, to like during the time of the day, kind of siesta hours, I suppose, when people kind of, you know, have lunch and they're kind of, you know, take a little nap here. Can also be translated more or less when it gets hot to make sure those gates are shut and not let anybody in, because it's, you know, it's a weak period in the day. But either way, this is Nehemiah's instructions on how to deal with the gates. And it all boils down to make sure that what we're doing with these gates is in accordance with the threat that's against us, more or less, because you don't want the gates to be open at a time when you're susceptible to attack. And not only that, but he wants to appoint guards among the citizenry and station them at their post and some in front of their homes. Why? Because, well, the city is wide and large, but there's not very many people in it. And either no houses, they could also be interpreted to mean there weren't many houses that had been rebuilt in the city. So you got a relatively big city. You don't have enough people to guard it. And so you want everyone to be on high alert. You want the gate guards to be on high alert. And, you know, we're not out of the woods yet, in other words. So we need to make sure that everything that we're doing is going to keep us safe from these external threats.
Yeah. Well, you know, you got to build the wall before you rebuild all the houses. You don't want to rebuild all the houses with no wall, right? So so the wall is yeah, done, but there's still building that needs to go on. Now we're going to have to rebuild the inside, right? We've got walls to protect us. We're going to have to rebuild the inside. And it sounds like we're going to need some more people. Sounds like we don't feel like we got enough people in here, so we'll have to see how that goes. I mean, Nehemiah is going to have to get himself some more occupants. And
yeah, I got to move some people to Jerusalem.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Fill the city up.
So we'll see how he solves that problem in the next episode. Chad, I will see you then.
All right. See you then.